I'm not going to try to go through that chapter page by page in class, but I think you're going to want to for yourselves, that accounting is sort of like a language, and it gets less confusing as you look at one thing and say, that doesn't make sense, and then figure out why it does, and that doesn't, and figure out why it does, and eventually it starts to make sense. So my suggestion is that in going through the chapter, any place where there's a line that seems to you not to make sense, if you can't figure it out, make a note of it and bring it up in class, and I think I can explain everything, although I don't swear I can. But what I will be trying to do is a sort of a more of an overview of my understanding of what's going on, and then we're going to be going through some of the specific problems, hypotheticals that they have in the book, and trying to see how they work out. So, but I think it would be a great mistake to just listen to what I say, look at my PowerPoints, and not read the chapter pretty carefully, because there's a lot of stuff in it. And I suspect that of all the things in the course, the accounting is probably the one you're most likely to end up actually using as lawyers, because you're going to be looking at accounts of firms and organizations for various reasons, trying to figure out how much money you can get out of them, or whether your client should invest in them, or whether their definition of profit, which your client is going to share in, is actually a definition designed to reduce profit to zero, and other things of that sort. All right. So accounting starts out looking quite bizarre when you first look at it, and I wanted to sort of run through the ways in which it seems wrong and the explanation of those ways as the beginning. And that to begin with, accounting only counts things that are measurable. Yeah? I'm sorry. I thought the screen was on. Why is the screen not on?
It's a good question. It's on a minute ago, I guess. Something must be timed out over here. Yes, so. Claims, it's warming up.
Yeah, one problem with the way this thing is organized is that I'm looking this direction and the screen's behind me, so I don't see when it's at. Has it come up? It has not come up yet. It's coming up. I think it's coming up.
Am I wrong, or is it looking awfully pale? Is that full brightness? What?
It's getting better. This might be better. I guess that's all right. All right. So that you could have a firm whose stock value was $1 billion that had practically no assets as measured by an accountant, because things like firm goodwill, many forms of intellectual property are worthless from an accountant standpoint, the exception being things that you've paid money for. That since it needs a number, if all that happened was that you came up with a brilliant idea which is going to make you $1 billion, that isn't going to show up on the accounts until the $1 billion starts coming in. On the other hand, if you bought from an inventor a patent on a brilliant idea that you paid $1 billion for, that's a $1 billion asset. If it's really worthless, you're in trouble, but on the books it's a $1 billion asset. So the basic rule is measurable things, and that means that intangibles show up only if they've been bought, if there's a, and furthermore, the way you measure them, with some exceptions, is by their cost, not by their current value. And if you have a piece of land that you bought for $10,000 and is now worth $1 million, that's still a $10,000 asset. All right. And the other thing along those lines that also seems a little odd is that all probabilities are either one or zero. So that if you are a defendant, if your firm is a defendant in a tort case, and you believe you're going to win, meaning there's a 25% chance you're going to lose, and if you lose, you're going to owe $10 million, that is not a liability. That will only show up as a footnote somewhere on the accounts. On the other hand, if we've got the same case and you believe there's a 55% chance you're going to lose, that's treated as if you were certain to lose. So that's treated as somewhere as a liability equal to the full amount of the expected damages. All right? So if you think about measurable, that often means that cost is the measure, and all probabilities 1 or 0. It's clear that that's going to give you a very distorted picture of the world, but it isn't too hard if you think about it for a while to see why it's a sensible way of doing it if you want to have a way of producing numbers which is reasonably simple and predictable and mechanical, as it were, which you do. If you think about it, it's actually rather like tort law. That in tort law, all probabilities are 1 or 0, too, in the same sense. That if I sue you for $1 million, and it is the opinion of the jury that there is a 60% chance that I was responsible for your injury, how much money do I owe under the more common tort rules? $1 million injury, and evidence isn't very clear, but they think there's a 60% chance that I'm the one responsible for the injury. What do I owe? $1 million. How about a 40% chance? Zero. All right, that's preponderance of the evidence. So tort law has got the same odd feature. Now, I'm oversimplifying because you've got things like negligence and such where you start thinking about probabilities, but the sort of basic guts of tort law says either you did it or you didn't do it. If you did it, we'll treat that as certain. If you didn't do it, we'll treat that as certain. And although it doesn't go quite as far as accounting does in simplified costs, I think if you look at tort law, it also has a strong preference for looking at costs that are readily measured. So that your medical costs, your lost earnings, those clearly go into your judgment. Pain and suffering, maybe, but that's going to be harder to get. All right? One of the things that I regard as particularly bizarre in common law tort, especially common law tort before about the mid-19th century, is that it treats the value of human life as zero. Right? That's not the way the law puts it. It's the way an economist would put it. But if you're in 1820, if I tortiously cause you to die, what damages do I owe? Anybody know? My negligence resulted in your death. What? Nope, I owe no damages at all because your claim died with you. Now let's take it to 1900, or for that matter to 2000. Under current law, if I tortiously cause you to die, what damages do I owe? Anybody know? But how are they calculated? What is the sort of rough rule on figuring out the damages when I cause your death? That's the critical point. That the damages will be based on the value of your life to other people. Right? To your wife, your husband, maybe your employer under some circumstances. So that means the value of your life to you is still zero in modern law. If you are a person who has no dependents, you consume all of your income, you know, you're retired or something, you're having a happy life, enjoying yourself, and somebody negligently runs you over, in principle, at least, he doesn't know anything because nobody but you was harmed and you're not there to claim anymore. So that's sort of one of the weird things about tort law. But even short of that, the preference for measurable harms is similar to, though less extreme, than accounting. I think that's a fair statement. And I think in both cases, the basic logic is the same, which is that you have a decision-making mechanism which is much cruder than the way in which a CEO can make decisions, for example, or even the way in which you can make decisions for your own life. Because the tort case, you've got a bunch of amateur jurors deciding what happened. Hard enough for them to decide whether you probably did it or didn't, whereas deciding whether it's 50%, 57%, or 63% is going to be a real pain. And in the case of accounting, we would like rules that are rigid enough so that people can't easily juggle the results. That if you think about you're the CEO of a company, you want to take out a big loan, you hire an accountant, the more flexible the accounting rules are, the less value the information that accountant generates is. Because the more you can say, here's a judgment call, make it this way, here's a judgment call, make it this way, I'm not going to tell you, but you know what result I want. And so you have a system which it seems to me is basically buying simplicity and predictability at the expense of accuracy and precision. And that's, I think, not an unreasonable trade-off, but you have to recognize it's being made. If you're an investor, say, you'd like to know about the accounting, But you'd really like to know more than the accounting. You'd also like to know, do they have assets that are worth much more than the accountants show, or liabilities that are worth much more than the accountants show? That after all, suppose that the firm has been separately sued by 20 different plaintiffs, each with a 40% chance of winning his case separately. All right, from your standpoint, that's a whopping big liability, but it's not going to show up on the statements. It will probably show up on the accounts as a footnote, the fact that those cases exist. All right. But anyway, I think that's the basic way I like to think about it. And then in accounting, as the book explains, there are basically three different ways in which you summarize the data. And the balance sheet is what they refer to as a snapshot. That's saying, here is a firm at this instant. What is its condition? What are its assets and liabilities? And normally you have two snapshots that you're going to want to compare, and typically they're a year apart. Assets equals liability plus equity. Is it obvious to everybody why that's true or not? Because it's sort of important in doing accounting. Suppose you looked at the firm. How much is a firm worth if you subtract out both its liabilities and its equity, that is, its value to the stockholders? What then would the value of a firm be? What does it have to be conceptually?
Zero.
Zero, right? Because the stockholders are the ones who own the firm. There's nobody who owns whatever is left. So the equity is simply what's left, assets minus liabilities. All right. And as we will see later, this fundamental equation explains both the way in which double entry bookkeeping is done, because double entry bookkeeping is done in such a way that every transaction you have two entries which combined keep that equality going, so that you have an asset increases and a liability increases, or an asset increases and another asset decreases, or and so forth, but always some paired changes which cancel out so that you still have assets equal liability plus equity. That's the balance sheet. And the book goes into the more details about how you have the more liquid assets at the top and the less liquid assets going down and so forth. Income statement is showing what's happened over a period of time, typically a year. And it basically starts out with the firm's revenue. Then it subtracts out the expenses, more or less in the order of how immediately related they are to the revenue. So you first have your actual immediate expenses linked to that revenue. So we built 1 million cars. How much did we have to pay out in salaries, parts, and so forth for it? Net, take that out, and that gives you some sort of a gross, I think they call it gross income or something of that sort. Gross profit, maybe, I don't know. Then you say, but what about the salary of the president of GM? What about this, that, and the other things, all of the expenses that go not to a particular car but to running the firm? You subtract that out. How about the interest expenses, the income tax we paid? You subtract that out, and you're left with how much more value the firm has at the end of the year than at the beginning. I say value rather than money because the cash flow is a different statement. Do people see why a firm might have gained $1 million in value even though it had $1 million less cash at the end of the year than the beginning of the year? Why isn't it enough to just say how much money is there in their bank account? What sorts of things does that leave out? What? One thing is that there could be other people who owe them money, that they've delivered goods and not yet been paid for them. What are some other things? Yeah.
If securities have appreciated, then they wouldn't have redeemed the cash, and so they would have a higher value.
Huh. That's an interesting question. Because the normal rule, of course, would be that everything is at its purchase value. And in the case of marketable securities, that might not be the case because there's a well-defined price. And I don't remember if the book ever actually covers that case. I'm not sure where they go in the books. Though I guess you could figure out. What else is going to increase or decrease that might be relevant to how valuable the firm is before and after?
Depreciation.
Appreciation would be one thing. What else?
Could have purchased property or something like that worth more than
Yeah, they could have inventory, they could have other assets such as land that basically, you know, money is nice stuff, but the company isn't really there to play with money unless it's, you know, speculating in exchange rates or something. It's there to produce and sell goods. So if your inventory increases and you're eventually going to sell that inventory, that's an increase in your value. That goes into income, even though it's not going to go into cash. So the cash flows, which presumably has the one virtue over everything else that is the hardest one to fudge, because, you know, a dollar is a dollar is a dollar. And the cash flows, you start out with income, and then you say, what are all of the things that give you income but don't give you cash? All right, what are the ways in which we could have gotten $1 million in income and, sorry, no green paper appeared? What are obvious ways? So we sold goods. People haven't paid us for them yet. All right. You adjust by everything that goes the other way. What are things that increase your cash without representing any income? What? Somebody paid you for goods that you haven't delivered yet, or the payments from last year for the goods you produced have now come in. All right, you took that as income last year, because those were money that was owed to you, and it's now switched from money owed to you to money you have. So what you're basically doing is taking the income and subtracting out all of the ways in which you get income without cash, adding in all the ways in which you get cash without income, and that ought to end up with the amount of cash that you have, and you then look in your cash box and see if that's the right amount, or your bank statement, more likely. All right? Also, as you probably already all know, parentheses are the accountant's version of a minus sign. Right? With color, you could also use red, but I'm not going to. All right, let's look at it more carefully. Balance sheet, as I say, is a photograph of the firm at one instant. Assets, most liquid at the top at two periods. The assets involve things that give you probable, better than 50% chance, future economic benefit from past events. You have current assets, and then you have long-term assets. The total is the total assets. There is a similar list for liability in the owner's equity. Liability is a negative asset. It's a probable sacrifice of economic benefit. Why does equity go in with... Why, when you're drawing up your two columns, does the equity and the liabilities go together? Because that's one of the counterintuitive things. You say, wait a minute, equity is a good thing, liabilities are a bad thing. How come... Yep?
The only way that you could acquire an asset is either through incurring liability or through contributions from shareholder equity.
That's one way of putting it. Yeah, a different way of putting it is the fundamental equation, that we're going to want these two sides to equal each other. And one of the sides, I mean, to me the intuition is equity equals assets minus liabilities. But if you add liabilities to both sides, that's assets equal liabilities plus equity. And that means that in order to keep that balance, anything that adds to asset has to add to either equity or liabilities, and anything which subtracts similarly. So, and the more I think about it, the more the bizarre nature of the use of credit and debit really comes out of this relationship. That which really, the way I'd like to think about it is that something that increases equity is a credit. I mean, that's probably not where it comes from, but that seems sort of intuitively right. And since something that increases liabilities plays the same role as something in the equation as something that increases equity, that counts as a credit too, even though it's a bad thing rather than a good thing. And on the other side, balance that with debits. And then the point I already made, that the firm itself has no wealth at all. All of the wealth of the firm belongs to the stockholders, if there are stockholders. And if there were a single proprietor, it would all belong to him. But in any case, the equity is the net assets. Income statement is designed to show the changes over a period of time. Money is coming in as, for example, sales revenue, and you then have costs. costs of the goods sold, raw material, labor, etc., operating expenses, interest expense, income tax. And you end up, after subtracting everything, with net income. This is the point we've just made. This is just a longer version of it. The cash flow statement, the money comes in as net income. If some of it is accrued but not received, that goes into accounts receivable, not into cash. So you therefore have less cash. So you have to subtract out from the income the increase in accounts receivable. If some of the accounts receivable from the past get paid off, you have a decrease in accounts receivable. That means that cash will increase even if there wasn't any income. So that's a respect in which the cash change is greater than the income change. Accounts payable, they're exactly the same in the other direction. They're what you owe other people. If your accounts payable go up, what will the effect of, and what will happen if there's an increase in your accounts payable from last year? How will that affect the relation between cash and income? Will an increase in accounts payable result in your having more cash than you otherwise would have, or less?
More,
of course, because you haven't actually paid that cash out. Exactly. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, this stuff felt pretty confusing to me when I first read it, and I don't know to what extent you people have already absorbed it or not. So if I'm being too kindergarten-y, tell me. Similarly, depreciation. What is depreciation? Intuitively, what does depreciation represent? Because it's another thing where the accountants and the income tax people really have it wrong, and yet you can see why.
Loss of value over time.
Loss of value over time, and the problem, of course, is that not everything loses value over time. Some things gain value over time. But it's some mechanical formula, and at least for when I've done my income taxes, you look up what class of assets this counts as, and they tell you it loses such and such a rate. And anybody know what's the depreciation rate for computers? For accountants or for the IRS? Any guess?
3 years.
What? Per year. What?
Oh, per year.
Or how many years until they depreciate entirely?
2 or 3.
It ought to be. I mean, given what actually happens to the value of computers, maybe 3 or 4, but not very long. I don't know if it really is or if they're still in some category which is 10% a year or something. But anyway, and then in addition, cash can come in because you borrowed. It can go out because you paid dividends and various other things. So these are just three different ways of keeping track of the information. One of them is a balance sheet, one is an income statement, one is a cash flow statement. And each of them is one thing which is, as it were, summarizing the whole firm for the year. Whereas, as we'll be seeing, the T accounts, which we get into in a bit, are looking at particular transactions and how they affect particular things like inventory, cash, and so forth. T account records single transactions. Now, that's really a pair of entries on a T account. Record a single transaction because the T account, if you look at the ones in the book, which is most of what I know about it, cash, they have this one, then this one, then this one, so that T account has actually got several transactions, but each one is shown. Every transaction appears twice. If you buy something, that decreases cash but increases whatever kind of thing you bought. So if you bought raw materials, you now have an increase of raw materials by the amount you spent buying it, not by its current market value. Similarly, factory land, whatever. You sell something, that increases cash. In order to sell it, you had to have it. If you had it, it was in your inventory. You therefore decrease the inventory. And then the first puzzle which struck me thinking about this stuff really is, how in all of this balancing stuff do you handle it if you make money? So you buy something for $100, that's fine. Cash goes down 100, inventory goes up 100. You sell it for 200. Cash goes up 200, inventory goes down 100. It doesn't seem to balance. What are we missing? Where is that $100 you made eventually going to end up? Where does it have to eventually end up? What? In equity, that's right. The firm's worth $100 more than it used to be. Correct. So every increase in assets has to be balanced by either an increase in liabilities or a decrease in another asset or an increase in equity. And as you see, as you go through the chapter, I initially, when I saw this, thought, aha, that's simple. We will have a T account for equity and extra $200. That's not how it goes. What happens is that the $200 shows up in income. Your hundred, you have a $100. That's right. What's going to happen in this case, if I've got it right, you can correct me if I don't, my $200, is I subtract $100 from inventory, and to match that, I have $100 on the cost point, which is going to go into my income statement, because the income statement is going to have costs of goods sold. So the cost of that good sold was $100. And then I have a $200 in cash, and that matches a $200 in income, in revenue. So, can people follow that? Because it took me a while to follow it, make sure.
Can you write it on the board?
Yeah, sure. Why don't I do that? Because
if I can erase this, this is mine anyway. Get that into the accounts. So we start out that we buy an asset, and I haven't done this for a long time, so I may get it wrong, but this ought to be DR and CR. And when we buy an asset, if this is cash, we have a credit of $100. Which represents the fact that we now have $100 less. And if this is inventory, we now have a debit of $100 because we've got the thing that we bought. Everybody with me so far? Now when we sell it, we have a debit to inventory of $100. And a credit to cash of $200. And that's where the problem arises. And the solution to this is that down here, we have revenue or something like that, and revenue has got a $200 term here, and we've got cost, and it's got $100 here. Because from an accounting standpoint, the cost of the thing we sold is what we paid to get it in the inventory, so that's $100, whereas the revenue was the amount of $100. $200, everything balances, and when we close out our books at the end of the accounting period, these things go to the income statement. The income statement ends up with a net income. The net income ends up with retained earnings, ends up with equity. So I think, does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's how they handle it, and as I say, you're getting the benefit of several years of my frustration trying to make sense of this, but I think that's right. So, yeah, it would make life easier for me if they left out that whole income thing and just had an equity part of the T account, and we could just stick it there as soon as it happened. But that would look sort of confusing, because it would be only $100 to equity and $200 to split it up and cut it in half and all sorts of other things they don't want to do. Anyway, all right. So, here is my brief explanation of credits and debits. At some point on the syllabus, I've got a link to a blog post I made that was my How Not to Be Confused Too Much by Accounting blog post, which hopefully is some use, but this is basically making the point that an increase in equity is a credit, a decrease is a debit. Anything that balances an increase in equity is a debit. So an increase in assets, oddly enough, is a debit. So when we bought this, that was a debit, because we now had an extra $100 widget in our inventory. Anything that an increase in liability is a credit,
let's say, I don't think I have any increase in liability here. Debits go on the left side of the T, credits on the right.
I've decided to memorize that by saying that since accountants get everything else wrong, they have the alphabetical order wrong too. The D is before the C instead of after the C. And that's a mnemonic to remember that the left side is the debits and the right side is the credits, which is one of the many things that often confuses me. So on the left side of the T is increases in assets, which count as debits. Decreases in liabilities, which obviously balance increases in assets, but also decreases in equity are debits, whereas the right side is assets going down, liability going up, equity going up. That's all of those are credits. I teach this course enough times, I may finally conclude that accounting makes sense. All right. T accounts and income. This is the point we were just going through, but here's the written, the text version. You buy some goods for $100. Your cash gets a credit of $100, meaning it goes down by that. The inventory gets a debit of $100, meaning it goes up by that. You sell the goods for $200. And we've seen how that shows up on the T accounts. And finally, when we close out the accounts, the sales revenue goes to the income statement as a plus. The cost of goods sold goes to the income statement as a minus. The difference goes to the retained earnings on the balance sheet. And the retained earnings are part of the equity. So therefore, sales revenue ends up as a credit. All right? So sales revenue as a credit is another exception to the rule that everything that ought to be called a credit is a debit, and everything that ought to be called a debit is a credit. And you can see why, I think, if you work through the logic of that, because the sales revenue is balancing the increase in cash, and an increase in cash is, of course, a debit. All right. And costs of goods sold is, again, a debit. So income statement things actually sound like what they ought to be, as they do with the equity, and everywhere else they don't. So let's try running through this very simple example out of the book. I think, I don't remember if it's in your book or just in the stuff. I've got a bunch of stuff they gave me on a CD, which are examples. And so some of the things I give you as examples are ones from the book, and some of them are theirs, but not that. Joyce James graduated from college in June of 2002. Her parents paid all of her expenses. On the date of her graduation, she has no resources, no obligations. So if we were writing a balance sheet just for fun, Jane, and we are going to start out with graduation and her assets are zero, her liabilities are zero, her equity is zero. All right. And so I guess, let's see, I guess it's liabilities, equity, somewhat funny term, assets, zero, 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 and sure enough, the fundamental equation is true. Zero minus zero equals zero. And she is thinking about putting together a financial statement for herself, which seems a somewhat odd idea unless she's taking a course like this. And one of the questions is, how should she do it? Should she set up a balance sheet? Should she set up an income statement, a cash flow statement, whatever? And the other is, how does everything go? And we have a sequence of transactions. At her graduation exercises, Joyce was awarded a prize of $5,000 for her senior thesis on day hiking in Ireland. The prize came in the form of $5,000 bills, right? Which, of course, she can't cash because anybody who sees them will assume they're counterfeit. But aside from that problem, you know the story of the very, very careless counterfeiter who ran off a batch of $24 bills? And he figured, where can I get people to take $24 bills? Aha, I'll go up to some little local small town up in Vermont where, you know, they're bumpkins. And so he goes after the small town. Vermont says, mind giving me change for a 24? And the stroker says, sure, what do you want, 4/6s or 6/4s? Anyway, so she spent $2,000 of her prize money buying books, which she would need for graduate school. She spent another $2,000 traveling through Europe over the summer and collecting memories of a lifetime, and at the end of the summer she took out a $4,000 loan to cover the costs of graduate school. So before we actually go into accounts, in terms of our concepts, what's that $5,000 prize? What is that? That's an asset, and what's going to balance it?
Equity.
Equity, right? She didn't, no liability there, so that's equity, or whatever we think of as the equivalent of equity, net personal worth or something, some phrase that's going to be the equivalent of equity for a firm. She spends $2,000 of her prize money buying books for graduate school. What's going to be happening there? What things go up and down that balance?
Cash goes down.
$2,000. That's a credit to cash.
Asset, books goes up.
Yeah, I don't know. Not quite inventory, working materials, no way to call it, but she. Yeah. Anyway, she has property, maybe, or I don't know what you'd call it, has gone up by $2,000. She spends another $2,000 traveling through Europe over the summer and collecting memories of a lifetime. Just seeing a story on a web news source that I use about someone having done some research showing that memories are more valuable than objects in terms of making people happy or something, or experiences are more valuable than objects for making people happy. So that's $2,000. What's going to happen? Yeah?
The assets go down 2,000.
What asset goes down by 2,000? Not her books. What? Cash goes down 2,000 and equity goes down 2,000. What about all those memories of a lifetime? I mean, they're worth at least 6,000. Shouldn't they appear somewhere?
No.
No. Good answer. No, that's right. No market price. She produced them, but she didn't buy them. If she bought somebody else's memories, then we'd have a case. But that requires technologies we don't yet have. And at the end of the summer, she took out a $4,000 loan to cover the cost of graduate school. So what's going to happen there?
Liability,
$4,000 liability in the form of a loan and...
So
that's it. Yeah, cash, or probably, let's suppose it's just cash, $4,000. So first question then is, why might she want a financial statement? Can you think of some other reasons or fill these out? What are reasons that you might feel like you wanted to sort of add up your financial condition?
Planning for the future.
But it's tricky.
You have a certain amount of money to do something that you wanted to do.
Because I assume I must have lost several hundred thousand dollars over the last year or so because I own a house here. And yet that's... Right? And yet that's almost... What?
Inequity?
That is... That my personal... Or my family... My family's wealth includes a house, a lovely house, in San Jose. And I don't know... I think we paid about $500,000 for it, but that was... 14, 13 years ago, so my guess is a year and a half ago, it's probably worth close to $1 million, given the way housing goes up. I don't know what it's worth now, but I assume something between $500,000 and $800,000, let me guess. So in these terms, now of course in these terms, none of that's going to show up, right? Because it wouldn't show up unless we sold it. And in this particular case, I agree with the accountants, because I'm planning to stay. House provides exactly the same service. You know, if I was really lucky, they might cut my taxes on the grounds it was worth less, though. That's not very likely. But, so, one reason is she's making her plans for the future. And another reason, so one way is to try to summarize information for herself. And accounting isn't really very good for that, because she probably has better information from that. the accounting. She looks at the what we've just been describing as, oops, going to Europe was a mistake, but it wasn't a mistake because she can evaluate those memories for herself. But also for other people, so that if she wants to borrow money, people, and she says, well, what's the evidence I can pay you back? Well, I've got these wonderful memories of a trip in Europe. That's nice, but they're not marketable. Not until we've got memory transfer technology, which is going to be a little while. And of course, if the memory transfer technology didn't take the memory away from the first person, then they'd be valueless anyway, because production costs would be roughly zero, and therefore the price would get very low. Just think of all the memories you could have with that technology. I don't know. It'd be an interesting question if you imagine it. I've sometimes thought that there are various experiences that I'd hate to have, but in some sense would like to have had. For example, being a soldier in a war. Be a terrible experience, and you feel somehow as though you'd sort of be more of a person if you had been through that. And so once we've got the necessary technology, anyway.
I'm sure there's a Bill K. Dick book about it or something.
There's a what?
I'm sure the Bill K. Dick wrote something about that.
It would not be surprising. Or someone else, yeah. Or you could. Yeah, I have one of the things on my webpage is a list of stories for other people to write. Basically story ideas where I think there's a neat idea, but it's not a story that I want to write. And I've gotten people who said they've actually written stories from that, or asked if I mind if they did or something. Sort of when you're young, you worry about other people stealing your ideas, and when you're old, you worry about other people not stealing your ideas. One of the ways you can tell as you're getting older. So anyway, so what kind of information is most useful to her? And it seems at least plausible that a balance sheet would be more useful than the other kinds. Now, you might want to look at an income statement and say, how did I do for the last year? You might want to look at a cash flow statement to know whether she can actually pay her bills next month as opposed to long-term things. But on the whole, the balance sheet is going to show how she's doing, and we're going to want T accounts to get there for our benefit. All right? So let's run through what we've just done verbally, but we can do it on the board. She gets $5,000 to the T account. And the T account is going to show cash. And it can't show equity because as far as I know, T accounts don't show equity, but it can show something like income. All right. And the income will eventually end up as equity. So what happens when she gets her $5,000 prize? So that she doesn't drink it all up celebrating. Where does the $5,000 pay match things?
Cash on the debit side.
Cash on the debit side. And income on the credit side. And the real answer is equity, but it isn't equity yet. Or it is equity yet, but it's not in the accounts. She spends $2,000 on books. Where are the two things? Where does the expenditure go?
$2,000 cash on that credit side.
Right. And where, what account do we need for showing the other side of that $2,000? Yeah, inventory is quite right. I don't know what the business equipment, right? Books or equipment for training her or something. I'm sure that's not the right term, but we'll call it equipment. And that's going to be $2,000 debit on that side. We are really happy. Hope so. Joyce is happy too. And she spends $2,000 traveling in Europe. Now, what? Where does the expenditure go?
Cash.
Which side?
Right.
The right side. And what balance is it? Yeah, this really ought to be an income statement. Is this how you do it? Maybe have
revenue on this side and cost on that side? Does that seem like a sensible?
I have to look in the book and see if they do that, but it makes sense if you're thinking about what we're doing. Anybody finds what they've done, tell me.
So where does that 2,000 go? On the left, that's a cost. Again, all this stuff is going to eventually flow into equity or net personal worth, whatever we call it. And of course, the memories are an asset, but not an accounting asset. She takes out a $4,000 loan to cover the costs of graduate school. Where does the loan go?
Cash goes up.
Cash goes up. That's $4,000. And what else happens?
Liabilities.
$4,000. Actually, let me actually label these things. Loan, prize, books, Europe. So I'll photograph the board and hopefully put it up on the webpage just in case anybody wants to keep track of this stuff, which I'm not sure they do. This was prize. And this was here. And this was books. Be more useful if my handwriting were legible. We can't have everything. All right. And she spends $5,000 on living expenses in graduate school. Where does that expenditure go and what balance is it? $5,000 cash living expenses and
income on that.
Yeah, on the income statement, which I'm guessing we call left cost, but maybe you just call it income statement. That seems right insofar as I understand this stuff.
Right. So if we put it all together,
all of this is going to go into a balance sheet. This was her balance sheet when she graduated, and this is, I think, a year later. Graduation plus 1 year is when I'm guessing this is happening. Assets, liabilities. What are her assets now? Cash? How much cash does she have? Very good. She got $9,000 and she spent $9,000. How about equipment?
Plus $2,000.
That's $2,000. Do you see any other assets? I don't see any other assets. How about liabilities? What liabilities does she have? She has $4,000 liability. It's the loan. Doesn't look too good, does it? And she has I think that's right. So if we look at it that way, what is her equity? Looks to me like it's minus $2,000. Now we could continue this process. We could have taken the, what would we do? We would work out from this a income statement, which is minus 2,000. All right, and that minus 2,000 would take us from equity of zero to equity of minus 2,000. All right, that's, if you think about the process by which the income statement, when we close everything out, gets folded into the balance sheet, that indeed balances out. All right, pretty happy with that. That if you look at your income statement, you had revenue of 5,000, costs of 7,000, net income minus 2,000, net income goes to, gets added to the equity before, and that becomes minus $2,000. Retained earnings were minus 2,000. So it looks as though we have a sad story for Jane. She's $2,000 in the hole. Do you believe it? Is that an accurate account of her situation? What?
She's a student, that makes sense. She's in the
life. What?
She's supposed to be a student, right?
Yeah.
So that makes sense that she's in debt.
But it also does not imply that she's doing a bad job of running her life, because presumably her year worth of graduate school, I'm wondering, I guess her graduate school must have been free from this description, right? She went to a state school back at a point when state schools were free for residents, and that explains, but she's now hopefully got a year's worth of education, which she at least believes increases her future earnings by more than that, $2,000. So as I say, so if you're thinking about loaning her money, what's your reaction to looking at this balance sheet?
I mean, it depends, because, you think more than just that. You'd actually go into it, you would just look at the numbers themselves.
Maybe, but take the information the balance sheet provides. Does she look like a good risk as a borrower?
Probably.
Right, she can't sell those books for very much, and she already owes $4,000 to somebody else. How about if you're thinking about marrying her? There might be other assets and liabilities that would be relevant, maybe more relevant, but the fact that she's, in accounting terms, has a negative value isn't very interesting to you, because if you marry her, you're going to be sort of associated with her for a long period of time. You will hopefully get some of the benefit of that education. And, yeah?
Theoretically, it would be a good thing to marry her whenever she's worth very little and then divorce her whenever she's worth a lot, because the state will look at it as you contributed to her building that wealth.
I suspect that'll depend on the state and on the court and such, but that is certainly a possible.
That.
What?
I second that. You want to take in a bum and then you want to.
But you really want them to get rich at their
expense.
You want them to get rich at their expense, not at yours,
right?
You don't want the situation where the reason why she ends up rich is that you've been paying all the cost of putting her through graduate school, and then she divorces you when she gets out and has to become a doctor and make a fortune, and you only get
right. Yeah.
You'd like to know what she's going to graduate school in. I mean, English literature, it's got its limits. Engineering, computer science, maybe. Yeah. I don't know if I told you people about the interesting bit of statistics that I saw a report on. I didn't see the original article on the effect of what college you go to on your income. What? I did tell you about it. So if you're thinking about going to Harvard, not unless they give you a scholarship. All right. Another general point, which we're going to want to include, is since these accounting things are typically sort of year by year, your balance sheet is at a given instant, but you're comparing it to a previous point, your income is literally for a year, your cash flow is literally for a year, how do we decide where an actual transaction has stuff happening over a period of time, so that you sell the goods now, you get paid next year, you buy assets now, you sell them 2 years from now, and so forth. So how do we group these things? And the basic rule, which again I think makes sense, is that you try to write your accounts in such a way that revenue and costs that are associated with that revenue go together, so that
if I've spent money on buying assets, somewhere I want to put what I spent on buying them and what I got for selling them in the same box, as it were. And how do we do that? It means that we try to recognize income when it is earned, not when we get it, which means that you show your income as an increase in accounts receivable, even if it doesn't get paid till the next period. And that means that the next period, you have an increase in cash and a decrease in accounts receivable, so there's no net income coming from that. Similarly, for costs, you would like to try to defer costs until the point when they will generate income. That when I buy my computer, it, in a cash sense, is a cost right now, but it's a cost that produces an asset, so it's no loss on income. But year by year, we try very roughly to say, all right, it's going to lose its value in 3 years, so a third of its value treats as a cost each year. All right, so those are examples. We then have the confusing problem that two assets that are identical may be quite different for accounting periods because you bought them at different times at different prices. And indeed, you may have, as we have, I think, in one of these problems here, a tank full of fuel oil or gasoline. And if you could only tag the atoms, you know, there's 100 gallons in here of $2 a gallon gasoline and $100 in here of $3 a gallon gasoline. And how do you decide when you sell it which atoms you were selling? And this is a case where really the accountant's approach and the economist's approach aren't really the same. Suppose that you filled up a tank with gasoline at $3 a gallon and then the price drops to $2 a gallon. And you're now saying, I'm trying to decide whether to take a trip. Taking this trip is going to use some of my gasoline. In deciding how much the trip costs me, which is relevant in deciding whether I should drive or fly, what price for gasoline do I use? You're a rational decision maker. And you
use the cost of gasoline now.
What?
Use the cost of gasoline now.
You use the current cost of gasoline, because after all, you can replace the gasoline that you burn at current price. But if you do that for accounting, you're going to have a horrendous mess if you always use that rule, because then you will have stuff you paid $3 for, which you're treating as $2, stuff you paid $2 for, you're treating $3 and so forth. So what you do for accounting instead is to have one of two arbitrary rules, which are neatly called FIFO and LIFO. Fortunately, the initials have an adequate number of vowels to make them sound like words. And FIFO is first in, first out. So what that rule is to say, you are burning up 100 gallons of gasoline, you look at your past T accounts and you say, what was the first gallon of gasoline that I bought that I haven't yet used? What was its price? All right, the first gallon I used is at that price, and run through it. That's first in, first out, meaning that you're imagining, even though it's not really true, that you've got a bunch of cans of gasoline, and these are the cans from 2005, and these are the cans 2006, these are again 2007, I need one, I take it off the top of the pile, that's the 2005 gasoline, all right, that had a $2 price tag on it. All right, that's first in, first out. And then LIFO, last in, first out, which is just the opposite rule, which is to say, whichever gasoline I bought most recently is what I will assume I used. And I don't remember if the book discusses why you would choose one of those rules or the other, and I certainly don't know, but yeah.
Usually with accounting purposes, I don't know how to describe anything that's really relevant for us right now, but a first in, first out, usually grocery stores use that because it's more important to get out products that are going to expire more quickly, and those are the products they first got in. So if you're at a grocery store, if you go to the very back of, like, you know, milk is there in line, if you go to the very back one, it'll have the later date. And they use first in, first out because they want people to buy products.
That's a sensible rule for how to stock your shelves, but that doesn't really tell you how the accounting is being done, because the accounting, they're...
They do the accounting the exact same way because they theoretically know that people are taking the using first in, first out, even though there are people out there who will reach all the way to the back.
But if they're all identical things of milk from their standpoint, Now, you're going to say they're not identical because some of them are older than others.
Their value is less.
Yeah, that's an interesting... Yeah, but that doesn't have much to do with when you bought it, does it? That is, that it doesn't have much to do with how expensive it was when you bought it. Even if you're... I understand, but even if the milk that's almost ready to expire costs $3 a gallon and the milk you just bought $2 a gallon, if you're using a FIFO rule, your accounting is treating the milk that's about to expire as more valuable than the fresh milk, whereas it's actually less valuable because you don't get rid of it now, you're stuck. Right? So I'm not sure it certainly makes sense in terms of how you handle inventory. And then maybe you're going to argue it makes sense for accounting because although sometimes the gallons of milk are identical, sometimes they aren't, maybe your milk from a week ago was bought from one supplier and from another one 3 weeks ago, in which case maybe you do want to have how the accounting shows it match up with what's physically on your shelves. I don't know. But so who uses LIFO?
Right. Just example,
Yo. And but you don't think that they explained to you?
I don't remember.
Yes, they may not have. I mean, right. If you think about it from the standpoint of a lawyer, why all this matters? I sort of sketched that very briefly at the beginning, but going back to it. One very obvious issue is profit-sharing agreements that, for example, I write a book. I have a deal with the publisher, which typically is pretty straightforward. It's in the form of they give me an advance, they credit me with such and such an amount of money per copy of the book sold. When the credits pass the advance, they start paying me money. It's a nice, simple arrangement. But, of course, books also get translated. In fact, I've just had an inquiry from somebody in China who say that they understand that my masterpiece, that was their word, not mine, Future Imperfect, has been published, and they're interested in translating it and publishing it. Fine idea. I'm delighted to spread the word to China. I'm sort of an optimist about China. I figure that the direction everything is moving and about the point the U.S. has gone to hell, China will have become a great place. Sort of the lines are crossing. But besides, you know, whatever their population is, it's awful large, and a lot of them are very smart people, and I like being read by smart people. It's rewarding. But presumably, now in this case, actually, it turned out that my publisher doesn't own those rights. I own those rights because I've got an agent who is greedy about keeping stuff for us. But if the publisher did own the rights, somewhere in the contract there would be some statement about how we divide the revenue from the Chinese translation between the publisher and me, and that's going to ultimately probably be in accounting terms. It might be as simple as, you know, 10 cents per copy sold, but it probably isn't. It's probably more like I get 50% of the profit and they get 50%. It's not going to be 50% of revenue because, after all, they got to... Well, actually, maybe it is because my publisher doesn't have to print those books, so it might be 50% of revenue. But anyway, my point in general is if you're drawing up contracts for things like authors who are contracting with their publishers and there are subsidiary rights, there are film rights when Future Imperfect gets made into a hit movie, which does not strike me as very likely. But I've got one novel which could make a movie, though I don't think that's very likely either. Or rights for translations. My impression is that at this point, the revenue that I get for permissions to, like, you know, photocopy a couple of pages of a book for a class actually is significant. I mean, it's maybe 10% as large as my royalty revenue. I haven't kept track, but I was surprised to notice that it was more than 50 cents. When I looked at my statements. So all of those are going to be affected by contracts. You are drawing up the contracts. God knows I, as an author, don't have a very clear idea of how that sort of stuff should be set up. I trust my agent to do the job for me. And similarly, if you're trying to decide whether to make a loan or your client is, you may want to look at the accounting figures of the borrowers. I would be a little bit nervous about a borrower who showed large amounts of equity and very low amounts of cash. And furthermore, publicly traded